The following apologies. Honorable Kasim is on his way. Honorable Dombela has sent an apology. And Honorable Dubazana Dlamini will also arrive a bit late. Honorable Khosa was here, he will join us. Honorable Van der Waart.
Morning, Chair. Honorable Jongbloed had a little bit of an accident in her house in Acacia Park. The geyser burst, it overflowed on the floor, she slipped and she got herself injured a bit. So I don't think she, and she couldn't write her own apology, I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. Well, sorry about that. We'll introduce ourselves so that we know each other. I know we did so. My name is Kassel Matale, committee member.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. My name is Maina Lesoma, committee member.
Morning, colleagues. Desiree van der Waal, member of the committee.
Good morning, Wilmani O'Drughan, voicing for me, sign language interpreter Trudy, and my other interpreter is Delphin. Good morning.
Thank you, Chair. Sejama Tapu Mutau, member of the committee.
Thank you. We will allow the department to do the same.
Colette Clark, DPSA.
Good morning, honourable members and colleagues. I'm Nita Bihari from the Department of Planning, Monitoring and Evaluation, the head of Frontline Service Delivery Monitoring. Thanks.
Sirisa Maduna from DPME.
Morning, colleagues, honourable members, we live with 18 DG, DPSA.
Good morning, my name is Utaseni Pope, Chief Negotiator, DPSA.
You can start again.
My name is Mfariseni Pope, the Chief Negotiator, DPSA.
Thank you very much. We'll then proceed with the agenda. The next item is briefing by DPME on the presidential hotline. We'll hand over to you, Dr. Buhari and Mr. Matuna. I don't know who's going to take us through.
Dr. Buhari will do the presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Matona. Good morning, honourable members, and good morning all colleagues around. Today I will be presenting the report for the presidential hotline as required by the committee. Basically, the committee had actually, this is actually a deferred agenda that was deferred over a period of time. And basically, what we decided with the secretary of the portfolio committee is that we bring the two together, the comprehensive report, but a report also on the successes, challenges, and failures of government departments in adhering to the prescribed response times on complaints referred to them by the presidential hotline. Basically, frontline service delivery monitoring has actually been integrated, and I think it actually needs a bit of, discussion at a strategic level to actually understand where the presidential hotline is actually located. In terms of the GPME is actually responsible for outcome 12. That is an efficient and effective, capable state, an active citizenry. Now, in terms of this particular model, frontline service delivery is where we actually go out in term in going into communities and actually working out measuring the quality of service that is available from the public service to communities. Now, there's basically two arms to the frontline monitoring approach. One is citizens monitoring government, that is the presidential hotline, where we are actually getting calls from citizens. The citizens-based monitoring system, the presidential special projects system, as well as the Isimbizos. So that is where we are accountable to citizens through a public participation process. And the other arm of it is government actually monitoring government. And it is actually frontline service delivery monitoring at a facility level and the presidential Siyashilola program there. Now, data is actually collected from citizens. This is the citizens based. We collect data from citizens for, you know, to actually feed into the policy cycle, to change programs, as well as for monitoring the quality of what citizens, how they actually perceive services, what are their needs. So basically the presidential hotline is one of the arms that we actually use to triangulate the information to support the other monitoring arms of frontline service delivery monitoring. So it is actually an impact indicator in the medium-term strategic framework, where the actual percentage of satisfaction by citizens on the resolution of the cases that are reported to the hotline is actually measured. And our target for that is 70% where we are there. In order to be a capable state, we have to actually understand the root causes of where our problems, our complaint management systems are. And in terms of our development, we actually now, in terms of evidence-based decision-making, we are using a theory of change approach and, you know, making it very evidence-based, as I said. So we used a theoretical framework to actually try and locate where our issues are. Now, this is from a strategic level because we deal with the presidential hotline at a strategic level, feeding into the policy cycle of government, but also at an operational level where we're actually managing the operations of the presidential hotline. So this is actually at a strategic level, and we can see that complaint management, a call center, you know, the hotline, is not just a hotline. The resolution of cases is actually dependent on the whole complex interdependencies within government. And from this diagram, we can actually see it is actually dependent on an effective intergovernmental relations system, intergovernmental system. And this is where, from a strategic level, you will see later where we are actually intervening at the center of government. And from this diagram, we have identified that the center of government is actually important from the way we actually operate. And the center of government, we can see here from this diagram that the Department of Cooperative Governance as local government is actually the missing link. We are going directly to the offices of the premiers and not really going through the Department of COCTA. And what we are finding out later in this diagnostic of the presidential hotline is really that we could use the presidential hotline as an oversight monitoring for the back to basics program. So this approach has actually changed the nature of how the presidential hotline actually operates as an oversight monitoring tool of government. It's basically not just a tool that, you know, that where citizens are actually phoning in. It's actually a tool for re-engineering the way government works in terms of service delivery improvements, in terms of responsiveness to citizens there. And we're also finding that from this diagram that national departments, the link between the provincial and provincial departments where there are concurrent functions, we have to map out accountability for complaints resolution across government. So just by this theoretical framework that we're using, we found that we can take the presidential hotline to a different level, to that strategic level that we need in terms of policy making. But we can't use it in isolation. We have to use it in with the other frontline monitoring tools that we are using in the Department of Planning, Monitoring and Evaluation unit. What we're also finding is that at the operational level, we are using CETA. It's an IT system. And, well, I'll get to that later, some of the successes. What we are finding is, well, we've done research and we actually did a quick survey with the public relations offices in government at the offices of the Premier. And together we found, we actually collectively came out with the successes of the presidential hotline. One of it is that the presidential hotline, one of the advantages is that it's strategically located and we can catalyze service delivery blockages just because we are at the highest office in government. And we've seen it at in our presentations to Cabinet and to the Presidential Coordinating Council. We've actually found that we are now, you know, people are actually now wanting to know more about it. We have used some of the approaches like impact of naming and shaming, but we can, you know, that's worked in terms of improving management practices in government. So we've transferred those knowledge skills, and we have found that we are getting more and more queries. We're getting more invites from departments, and this is at a political level as well as at administrative level. Data collected from the presidential hotline allows data to be disaggregated to different levels, to lower levels of government in terms of data, in improving our data that we're collecting. So we must also thank this committee in going out to on frontline service delivery visits. With this committee, we have used that information. We were forced to, you forced us to actually use those information in those oversight visits, and that actually demonstrated to us that we are sitting with a lot of information at facility level and at local government level. And this formed part of the briefing notes when we went out, and it was used in that particular committee. What we are finding is that short-term queries are resolved within the required 25 days turnaround times, such as water, because we get certain complaints that water, you know, they've actually complained to the municipality because of a water cut, but they want the water, it hasn't been reconnected. So those kinds of things, issues we have been responsive there as a government, as a hotline. But what we are finding with longer term issues, like the types of queries we get is not small time issues. We have to, it's like we're getting complaints that a resident actually needs a bridge to be built. Now we are, you know, as you're aware, that is not just a simple resolution. That requires going into the IDPs of the department. And no matter what, No, you know, although it is an almost something that we can't solve, but the important part of the hotline is to be responsive to communities and how we actually feed back to them and keep them in the loop. And this is where lots of our energies at the moment are going, in making sure that the complainant is actually kept in the with us, in the steps that we're taking in resolving the situation, no matter how big the issue is. The other one is the other successes that were identified by our counterparts in the provinces is that the presidential hotline has allowed citizens an opportunity to monitor government on service delivery across government daily. So on a daily basis, we're getting calls to tell us, you know, what are the expectations, what is the responsiveness of lower levels of government, because we are the apex complaints management system when other systems actually don't work. So as I said, it's been telling us, like the oversight monitoring, it's giving us a good indication of the Back to Basics program as an oversight tool. What we found is that real success has been realized. You know, we've circulated Annexure 1, and we can see by some of these, you know, by the range of cases where we've been successful is they, in these complaints, we have addressed some 30-day payments where people have accessed us to tell us about non-payment. There is a success story there. There's also two success stories to illustrate the successes and the impact of it on a case-to-case basis. I must stress, on a case-to-case basis, such as the Road Accident Fund. Also, you know, in terms of getting the person on the indigent register of the municipality, as well as, municipal, the three of the success factors is at local government level, municipal, as I mentioned, like electricity cuts, water, and one is an ID. So basically, we can see that we are making a difference in almost in being an advocate for the citizen, you know, in terms of the types of queries, like the road accident, in addressing the issues of the road accident fund. So we are dealing with the most vulnerable groups in society, but maybe not on the scale that we wanted. The presidential hotline is a participatory forum for all three spheres of government to resolve service delivery blockages. As I said, it is, but we can get better. In all this, I'm saying we can get better, and at the end you'll see the actions we are taking. The presidential hotline has improved over time, and we do have an enhancement plan. We have acknowledged quite frankly and openly some of the shortcomings of the presidential hotline, and we're making sure we address it, because I think what is important, acknowledgement and improvement, continuous improvement, because even IT is actually evolving all the time and is a dynamic process. So we have to, if we want to be on top of things, we have to constantly be on the alert for improvements. And we certainly have gone a long way there. But we also can transfer Bartopili skills and customer care, you know, through the system. We can entrench it because we are reporting at key decision making bodies. So it is a way of transferring some of those issues going forward. Some of the challenges that we are experiencing as an apex complaints management system is that there's weak complaints management systems of provincial and municipal hotlines, and the reliance on the presidential hotline. So sometimes, although we have quite a sophisticated IT system, sometimes at a provincial level and especially at municipal level, we have to actually work at a manual level and, you know, go back to the basics. which is not a bad thing for us in terms of learning, the learning and the growth there. We also have non-functional hotlines at the offices of the Premier, but I must say that has improved. We've been constantly working with them, and you know, we've been going out into the, our focus for this financial year was actually strengthening offices of the Premiers. And municipalities, as well as lack of accountability by responsible managers at provincial and municipal levels. But the presidential hotline is in the annual performance plans of all offices of the Premiers. So it is a lever for us to actually, you know, to have some form of accountability. That's unpacking in our planning document in terms of accountability and governance. It is presently in all the annual performance plans of all the offices of the Premiers. But we have to get the indicator correct in terms of performance measurement in the annual and use it. The main thing is using it. One thing is having it in the APP, but to use it for consequence and for accountability. But we are in discussions with our planning units around that. But also heads of departments in provinces do not regard the presidential hotline as a management tool to deal with the managers who do not take responsibility. But I think one of the things that is also changing, that we are slowly changing, is that the hotlines in government and the complaint management system is actually not just a complaints management system, but it is a monitoring and evaluation tool of frontline service delivery. So that is quickly being realized by departments. And you will see the types of reports that we are getting out is and presenting it, and people are soon realizing that it is a monitoring tool. This is an illustration of the top service delivery concerns referred to provinces in 2016-17 financial year. And not unexpectedly, the top 10 concerns that our citizens are telling us are a place to live, that's housing, water for household use, electricity, employment, not unexpectedly, roads, education and training, health services, sanitation, social benefits, information from government. So it is telling us, and we've been able to show it to departments like local government, COCTA. We've been able to show them that many of the problems are actually located at a local government level, not unexpectedly. But also we've been able to show more trends. So we're using the hotline more and more to show trends. And if we cross-tabulate this information with the community survey, we found that there's almost exact correlation with other forms of data collected from government. This shows us, once again, we had the power of breaking this down, the types of complaints referred to to provinces, and this, I must say, has not been aligned to the demographics of the country in terms of percentages. But we can make some inferences. For example, Gauteng province, once again, not unexpectedly, it is a province of urbanization. So we're getting the most complaints from Gauteng. But we also have to look at other factors, because now this is giving us the opportunity, because we have information like this, it's giving us the opportunity to actually become a more capable state in terms of the analysis. So what it's actually telling us now, that we need to go and look at migration policies in Gauteng province. We need to look at housing. So it's actually supporting other forms of data that's being collected. But as I said earlier, how we are going to use that information is going to be the important part. other issues like other, you know, but this information as well, like in the Western Cape, we can see water, use access to water. So it's also dependent on the time. So, for example, Western Cape is going through a drought. So we're getting more complaints about access to water, the water things. So this is something that we also, in our analysis, we are also moving, in getting our analysis up to a better level there. But it's because we are able to actually disaggregate this information to this level, it's actually telling us now when we need to go further. So that is one of the successes, I would say, where it's helping us becoming a more efficient, effective, and capable development state. The customer satisfaction survey, we do actually phone our, people who are actually are complainants, and we do ask them about their satisfaction of the service. But here I have to be quite frank that the methodology used, we are interrogating it once again, because we're improving all the time, and we've acknowledged that we need to improve the satisfaction survey methodology, and we're working very closely with Statistics South Africa, and we really want to get this right moving forward. At the moment, it stands at 62.2%, 62.3%. Our target is 70%, but now we know where the gaps are because we've identified where our gaps are, so we know where to target the interventions for satisfaction of our targets. I also want to say that we're experimenting with some of the things with the presidential hotline. For example, when we go out on the Isimbizos, what we've experimented with is to actually, because we go out on Isimbizos, we want to actually make sure that commitments, monitoring of the commitments are being made. So in certain visits that we've made, we found it quite successful that we are putting these issues onto the presidential hotline, and we are able to actually track them from an IT-based system through the hotline, the resolution, and it's work in progress, but I think it is something that's leading us to other ways of actually monitoring government services, because in terms of service delivery improvement, we're finding that the public liaison officers on the ground, we have quite a network of them, and they are following up on those commitments for us. So we are experimenting and piloting different ways of using our presidential hotline going forward. In conclusion, because this was a report, as I said, that was deferred, we've got the conclusion, but I will also bring it up to the progress that we are making. The complaints deferred, the resolution of complaints referred to departments by the presidential hotline. We really need to interrogate the whole service delivery chain along the three spheres of government. So we can't really solve it only through the presidential hotline, but we can solve it through the whole frontline service delivery methodology that we're using that I mentioned at the beginning. Strategically, we can actually solve it. We have to be simultaneously building capacity to measure and assess resolution of complaints. We're redefining what we mean by a resolution of a complaint, customer satisfaction, and redress mechanisms which operate close to the point of delivery. But it also requires strong leadership by DPME, Offices of the Premier, DPSA, and COCTA to fully realize an effective, responsive, and accountable public service through a comprehensive complaints management and integrated service delivery system. So basically, it is strengthening the working together of the center of government. The progress to date is We are, you know, we have got a draft concept paper on institutionalization of frontline monitoring in government. We are trying to, you know, it's going to be, it's a discussion paper. We are actually going to work with the offices of the premiers on how we can actually strengthen the institutionalization to actually make it become the most service delivery, to bring it to a higher level of importance in government from a strategic and an operational point of view. Because it has to be able to be, you know, we have to be able to track accountability, reporting, governance. These are important things that we need to unpack and how we actually move it forward. And what we've already started working with our colleagues in DPSA on how we strengthen the coordination of the Centre of Government in complaints management. On an operational level, we've got an enhancement plan. We actually have to deal with the CETA, with the, you know, the operations, and also keeping pace with technology. How we can act. At the moment, we're getting walk-ins, we're getting telephone complaints, we're getting letters, and we're getting faxes. But how we can actually expand now to keep up with the trends in technology. But what we are also saying is that we must be cautious. Let's get what we are doing, let's get that right before we move to other levels. Because what we've also acknowledged, we've got enough information. Now we have to focus on service delivery improvements, how we use that information to drive government to make those improvements there. But we've also got a communication plan and stakeholder management, because we also realize that we're accountable to government. So we have to actually go and get a communication plan at lower levels of government. So, for example, our commitments that we're making at the ISMBSOs, we must ensure that feedback and keeping the people in the loop through the presidential hotline must be to lower levels of government. But as I say, it's work in progress, these issues. We've got, because as we said, COCTA is actually a most, is our important partner, and we recognize the gap. And through our, this was one of our successes of our reporting and being the strategic location in government. We've got a MINMEC resolution of COCTA that we need to mirror the hotline complaints management system with the Back to Basics program, because now we are actually showing where the gaps are in the to verify the Back to Basics program. I must say, we've been working very well together with COCTA at a local government level, because we do, as I mentioned, most of these problems are local government. So we're shifting the focus of frontline service delivery to the bottom, to the, you know, to lower levels of government. And COCTA have been they've been very open to this. And at the provincial level, we're hoping to bridge that gap between the offices of the premiers and COCTAs at provincial level. We are actually having ongoing engagements with the Department of Planning of Public Service and Administration. We've just come out of an annual workshop, and DPSA, it was yesterday actually, I had to leave to come here, but DPSA was very, very strongly there. Their presence was strongly felt and appreciated by our offices of the premiers and by our partners as well. So basically, this is our presentation. As I said, all this is work in progress, but I think I have every confidence that we can strengthen the use of our hotline in going forward as a monitoring tool. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the presentation. We will allow members to make comments or ask questions. Yeah, Honorable Somo, Honorable Nivote, Honorable Mutau, welcome. Honorable Karim, we got your apology. Yeah.
Thank you, Honorable Chair, and thank you for the presentation. Why I'm thanking it is because at least you have tried also to give us the figures, how it looks like in terms of housing one. The point that I would like, Chair, to talk to is this. Have we made any deliberate assessment of Izimbizos, whether they add value? And because why I'm saying that, Chair, I'm not too sure whether we tend to talk to the same audience, and also are we also looking at the communication change landscape of our societies as well, other modes of communicating other than Izimbizos from where I'm seated, because they tend to be more class sectoral orientated, as it were. And then most of those people, they don't necessarily use phones or emailing or texting and all that. But how do you then make sure that moving forward then they take advantage or of the problem, as it were? And also probably even our stakeholders that we use in terms of sensitizing or popularizing the program, as it were. Because my feeling, Chair, also, I think we must launch or popularize it, because I think we are not doing enough in terms of the public space to create that awareness that it does make a difference, so that even your successes can be better measured. That one, Chair, I talk also to the complaint management system, your ITC, and the improving in terms of actually giving you the facts as they are, and also the capacity of your local government and municipalities in terms of lock-in, and also your dashboard that also tracks specific issue. Okay. Now I've spoken to slide 5 in terms of your success. That probably, Chair, around the success in terms of actually quantifying your success also, or our success in future, Chair, or it can be an additional issue. I'm suggesting should be an additional information in terms of categorizing of the issues, and also per provinces, if it's possible also to drill it down to municipalities, because I'm worried, Chair, that we seem not to be so caring in terms of the soft issues that are raised by our society, which are more operational matters, as it were, which can be easily resolved, because we wouldn't have had in 2016, Chair, the so-called public service protest if we're very clean and systematically in that space. No, you have raised the issue of... but also, Chair, I'm sure this one, DPME, would be better placed even through your DGDFSA forum of the DGs as well, also with the provincial DGs, to say how do we make sure that we increase the appetite and appreciation of the importance of this program. Because I think that's where we are lacking. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Honorable Nivo.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. I would like the updated presentation to be emailed to me, please, because I now have it now has the figures, and it wasn't on the original document, so I would like to study the figures, plus the other slides, which is also important for us to have. So please email that to me. You said that you have a tracking mechanism. I want to know, this tracking mechanism, is it only for national to do, or does the provinces also keep track themselves, you know, on provincial issues and the municipality, or is it only national, the hotline or the service that does the tracking? So just in terms of that, because eventually the provinces will have to do their own tracking as well. So just if you could answer that. And then the last time you came in front of the committee, I asked for an email address, and I emailed that address, and I received a response, so I was very happy with that, which is good. But the community I serve, the constituency, they are deaf. They don't always have access to emails, but they can text. They can send a text. So I'm not sure if the hotline has an SMS number. I will also like to know, if you do give me the number, can that number be used to send an SMS or a text? Plus, if it's toll free, because I'm not expecting, you know, maybe school children who want to make a complaint, you know, having to pay for an SMS because they can't afford it. They don't have the data necessarily. I'm very concerned that in the deaf community, maybe other disability groups as well, either they don't know about you as the hotline or they don't have access to the hotline. Now, to give an example, in the Eastern Cape, there's a school for the deaf. And for the third time, over a weekend, the children had no food at the school. Now, of course, they contact other deaf people or they contact the Deaf Federation of South Africa for, you know, assistance because there's no food at the school. Now, they should be able to contact the presidential hotline or another government official because it's a government school. It's run by government. It's funded by government. Now, they don't have any food there, and we can't allow the children to go hungry. Another deaf school from another province, for example, had to assist them to send food over the weekend to make sure that they have food. And the Deaf Federation was able to contact McDonald's and Pick and Pay in the Eastern Cape to also get assistance, plus gift of the givers had to come in there. Now, for me, it's very embarrassing to see the situation because the school should be able to, you know, run properly, make sure the children have food over weekends and long weekends. Another deaf school in the Northwest Province, you all know that the hostel burned down. The children couldn't SMS anyone. They could only let their parents know that there's a fire. But the presidential hotline, you know, maybe if they had access to that, they could have been able to send an SMS to the presidential hotline as well. I'm very, very worried. I said this question last week as well. When the numbers of deaf matrics who are deaf can't write their matric, they are adding to the numbers that the NYDA gave us of people, of youth without matric. And it's a struggle to receive matric. So for deaf people, it's even worse. They should be able to have access to the highest level, which is the presidential hotline, and inform them that I can't write my matric. What is going to happen to us? Because they don't have access. They have nowhere to make their complaints. I would also like the DPME what my question is, does DPME monitor and evaluate the Department of Basic Education on these issues? Because these issues are recurring issues, and we don't know what's happening in schools for the deaf and schools with special needs, for children with special needs. The parents don't know where else they can go. So DPME should come in and monitor and evaluate and assist the Department of Education. Is that happening or not happening? Thank you, Chair. That's all.
Thank you, Honorable Mutau.
My apologies, Chair. Last week, I think it was last week, when Limpopo and Mpumalanga reported to us, I asked a question to DPME and I haven't received a response yet. I haven't received a written response either. I said that in Limpopo, they're using, you know, the ID system of the patients. You know, there's a way that they're trying to implement it in the different levels of health. So I asked if that ID system can be rolled out and used in other provinces as well, because it's a very good idea and we don't have to waste money to repeat the same tests, you know, having to be done in the health sector. So I would also just want to know if someone can answer that, please.
Honorable Mutau.
Thank you very much, Chair. The first thing I want to do is to underscore what Honorable Soma said about a comprehensive sort of detailed feedback about, you know, what has been done so that we have a sense of that. The other thing that for me is always concerning, especially with monitoring and evaluation. And you underscore it again in your conclusions, where your third bullet point there, where you say we need strong leadership in the DPME. In other words, people are still not doing what they're supposed to do, and we pay them. They don't do what they're supposed to do and pay them. And we want to hold them accountable, which is fine, but when they don't do it, there are no consequences. I come from a world where when people were to be paid bonuses, they had to be evaluated and they on the targets they have set. Now, you set a target of satisfaction, public satisfaction, 70%. Why not 100%? I never, ever gave any one of my managers a 5 out of 5 score. Never. And the reason is very, very simple. If you give me a 5 today, what are you going to give me next month? When the score is 1 to 5. So I've always said to them, there has to always be room for improvement. If I give you a 5, you're done. That's it. You can, you know, stay for life. So I'm just saying, where were you talking about this strong leadership thing? Strong leadership is fine, but what do you do when the people don't do what they're supposed to do? And it comes back to the issue that I always have with the department. Monitoring and evaluation. It's nice to do the monitoring and the evaluation and stuff like that, but where we cannot actually show people that you have not done your job and you're going to have to face the consequences, we have a problem. We have a very, very serious problem. The other point that I'd like to comment about has to do with what you said. You touched all the right points. What needs to be done is to be done. We need to do these things. We've got to get the people doing things. We have a presidential hotline because we are not doing what we're supposed to do. Feedback. You touched on this. When somebody has complained, the feedback loop has to kick in, and then you've got to go back to them. It's a very basic thing. Where we give people feedback, people, even if you've not resolved their problem satisfactorily, they can say, that guy cares. It's come back to me. So the it leads to this issue of, do you ever get people coming back to you on the hotline and say, thank you very much. That question I raised with you or so-and-so at whatever level it is was satisfactorily resolved, and I want to thank you for it, because it cuts both ways. So for me, we need to still come, you have the discussion paper and stuff like that and all the things that you guys are doing, but we need to get to the point where people do what they're supposed to do. You use the word yourself, you say, your oversight business forced us to do this or the other thing. We don't have to force people to do what they are employed to do. These are the things that really, really bother me. We don't have a sense of why we are where we are at, why we get paid, why we get up in the morning every day to get to work. So if you can actually get to those things that you say need to be done, and they get done, next time you present, we'll have a different presentation. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. In the presentation, you said that to a greater extent, the resolution of some of the complaints depend on the intergovernmental relations. To what extent are these having an impact on resolving the problems that are there? You also spoke to the issue that premiers, let's say provincial hotlines, not all provinces have hotlines, or not all premiers' offices hotlines are functioning. How many hotlines are functional? and that the you were saying that HODs don't view this as a management tool to an extent that they don't use it to evaluate the work of the managers responsible for this. What is it that is being done to ensure that this is viewed as a management tool to be used by HODs? I think conversely, there's a question asked by Honorable Mutau about people giving you feedback on how you help them to solve the problem. Conversely, do you communicate with the people who raise issues with you that your problem has been resolved? I think those are the issues that I wanted to add on the questions that members have already asked. I don't know whether there is a member who have a question before we allow them to respond. Thank you. You can respond.
Okay. Thank you, members, for the questions. They are actually very thought-provoking questions. The first one, Honorable Lesoma, is the deliberations of the Imbizas. I think, well, we are definitely interrogating the effectiveness of our Imbizos. Certain steps that we have taken in relation to the Imbizos is that we've integrated our facility-based monitoring with the Isimbizos, in that it's not just an event, the Isimbizos, but it is actually something that is continuous. And our two recent Isimbizos, we've actually made sure that we went back to the community after a specified period of time to actually report on commitment. We've done that in the Denelton municipality and Maruleng as well, where we went back, we just, as officials, we actually made sure that we've kept that people in the loop. Also, to maintain it, we've made sure now that we're not only going out with us, by ourselves as the Department of Planning, Monitoring and Evaluation, we're going out with COCTA, because they also have provincial coordinators at a provincial level. So we're making sure that we keep in touch with the ground. Also, we've got 9 provincial coordinators now in our frontline units. We're making sure that they actually, because they must ensure that it's not an event and that there's processes involved. So it's a whole team that's going out, and it's not just the Isimbizo team that's going out, because that is a very big concern to DPME, that it's not just an event. And also that's why we've increased, what I've already said, that commitments, the monitoring of the commitments through the hotline, through an IT system that is actually working. And it has got a tracking system, so we can actually know where it is. We've tried it out in 2 places. I'm not saying it's perfect, but it's something where we will make sure that people do it, that we lead it in there. From a communications point of view for the Isimbizos, we've made sure that our hotline is a prominent part of the team. And as well as, you know, we give out our documents, our pamphlets, and we make sure that it's linked to our provincial coordinators that we leave behind, well, not leave behind, who continues the work there. But definitely we are looking at our communications. In that document of, you know, I mentioned we've got that institutionalization of frontline document. We're looking at the communication strategy in totality, and also a communication with a stakeholder management strategy, because of that differentiation that you've mentioned, of different stakeholders have different needs. So we are looking at that. In terms of dashboards, CETA, CETA has
we are working with CETA on that. We do have dashboards, but we're also looking at it from a data integration at DPME because we have a knowledge hub and a data, because we also, we're not only looking at frontline as frontline, we are integrating it within DPME, other monitoring systems. So we are actually looking at that part. We are trying to, in terms of categorizing and quantifying it down, we can actually categorize it down at a local municipality level and at a facility level. Actually, with in terms of Gauteng province, we're working closely with them. After the Presidential Coordinating Council meeting, they have put it on their agenda, on their cabinet agenda. So the presidential hotline is part of their provincial executive council meetings. They've come out to us and, regularly to monitor it in detail, the Gauteng province. And KZN was another province that had high rates of complaints. We are actually going to go into FORSAT. And as I said, in our institutionalizing document, we're looking at our whole reporting framework. We have discussed with COCTA that these issues at frontline should also be going through the municipal councils. It shouldn't only be at a high level. So, like, let's say our Siyashlola program, it actually is dependent on local government, lots of the bigger issues. So we are working with them on trying to ensure that it goes down into the whole reporting framework from top down to bottom up way. As I said, it's work in progress, but next time, we hopefully will be reporting on that. Our apologies, Honourable Member, for the new presentation, but we did realize that there were certain issues that we needed to add on, and also we needed to include qualitative information and quantitative. So this is why we actually added on to that, but we will definitely email that issue. We do track all these complaints. The complaints resolution is tracked. So, for example, if there's a complaint on water that was made, it's logged onto the IT system at CETA, and every time there's feedback to a feedback that's given to a complainant, or if a department, like let's say the Office of Northern Cape, actually have made some intervention, it's all put onto the system. So we can actually track it on the system, what happened. But the quality of the input of the people putting it onto the system, that is something we're working on. It just can't be, as I mentioned earlier, it's not just a call center kind of thing. They have to look at it in a whole community development kind of paradigm. In terms of SMSs, we actually don't have access to SMS access. It is a toll-free number that people can phone us, but we will definitely look at SMS as one of the tools going forward. I will engage with CETA on that. In terms of the deaf community, I think you've definitely given us food for thought, that we really do need to look at that at vulnerable groups in terms of our stakeholder management. And we are looking at civil society organizations as our stakeholders, and we will definitely include the Deaf Federation going forward and other disability sectors. I'll be honest that I when we looked at it, we weren't all inclusive, and we will definitely moving forward go on that. Do we monitor and evaluate the Department of Education? From a frontline point of view, we do monitor schools across the provinces, we do monitor schools from outcome two, and we do monitor
Department of Education from that point of view. In terms of last week, that visit, you know, the feedback from Limpopo and the ID system, GPME, it is, we will be looking, I think the brief was that we look at the Center for Service Delivery Innovation, what they were doing. We will actually take that forward. But I know in terms of health, at the M&E in Durba, the Center for Scientific and Industrial Research also has done, they reported that they've also done something for health on that ID, on a common ID system. So we will be getting together both these institutions to actually investigate how we could actually transfer it to other departments. That was the brief last week from there. In terms of leadership, we are looking at how we can make people more accountable and consequent, and the consequences, not only from a frontline point of view, but from the whole institutionalization of planning, monitoring, and evaluation that DPME is actually looking at there. And in terms of leadership, from a DPME point of view, we are actually pushing that leadership from a political level as well as an administrative level. So we're making sure, like, we do have support, because frontline does also executive support. In the information brochure that I've given you for frontline, you will see that executive support, that frontline service delivery is actually led by executive support, by the political leadership in the country, at the highest office. So every time we're going out, our minister makes sure that all our ministers, we are integrating frontline to be led by political and administrative leadership. Every time we're going out, we are visiting our facilities. As I mentioned earlier, we are integrating our programs, and we're going back with our political leadership to actually monitor the progress. Although it's actually oversight, but I think for a start, it's showing that there is leadership and that frontline is at the center of government, and we care as a community. At an administrative level, we are definitely are showing leadership in that we are going into FORSADs, we are going into, you know, reaching those people on the HODs and people at provincial levels through now going into MinMax. And there I must say, we are actually getting more and more invites from the departments themselves, which is a positive thing. So there is actually slight change from a leadership point of view. We've been invited and presented to the National Council of Health, and we've got a few more departments who've called us. So there is some change in government movement in departments. In terms of the oversight visits, I wouldn't say it was forced to think. It was actually, it extended our thinking, Honourable Ms. Mdow. It made us think a little bit more. It took us to a new level of thinking in terms of, you know, getting that to right to the facility level as well. Because we all are learning to be evolving as a capable state. And it definitely did show us a different way of monitoring. And I think it also, other examples that were taught there is let the offices of the premiers lead. You know, it showed us that DPME doesn't lead in those moments. Hold the offices of the premiers accountable. And I think last week at the briefing session as well, we got it in no uncertain terms that the offices of the premiers must be held accountable. And that has grown our thinking, rather. In terms of IGRs, the example that I could use is that, like last week, we actually had somebody who wanted a dam, a very disgruntled a citizen who didn't only phone the hotline, they phoned me to complain that they needed a dam in their particular area. Now what we had to do is we had to go into the IDP of that department. So, you know, the solving of the problem is actually involves the whole of government in terms of those kinds of complaints. But the important part is that we show the person that we care. So, you know, that it is a process, and actually explain to them that this is not something easy. It's about keeping the person in the feedback loop, as you rightly said. In terms of people telling us thank you, we actually do get thank yous. We've got a thank you from a school that we helped build that came in as a complaint to the president about a school that was dysfunctional in terms of infrastructure. And the school was actually built, rebuilt. And the person, actually, we got a very lovely letter from the principal of the school and from the community thanking us for the hotline, the complaint there. Just last week, we got another compliment and thank you from a school once again, the school principal, because it was a complaint through the hotline. And it was also a school that was, the infrastructure. And we managed to get Eskom as a partner, one of their partners, as their social responsibility to actually assist in building the school. So, you know, those are the good things that we do. But we do realize that it's not only the infrastructure. Now we need to go forward and monitor the quality of education in those schools. But definitely we do get very gratifying thank yous and some compliments going there. The hotlines in offices of the Premier, sir, is actually now all functional. We're working very closely with the hotlines. But the issue, the problem that we found, the challenge is that the hotline was not viewed as an M&E tool. It was actually something that was actually looked at just on the side. But now, more and more, we've brought it to the attention of offices of the premiers that it is in the APP. So they are actually, it is something that they have to drive in provinces. So they are working hard to resolutions, but in terms of capacity and the training of their public liaison officers into the M&E sphere now, we have to move forward. That we have to strengthen the monitoring capacity and actually using the information collected for the hotline more analytically to drive the change process and, to drive service delivery improvements and to use it as an early warning system as well. So you know, we still have to get there. And we do communicate feedback. You know, it's not perfect, but we are encouraging that our call center agents to ensure that we do get feedback and also put feedback in writing where possible. If we get something in writing, we give feedback in writing. So to the point that I myself am getting more and more complaints directed to myself in the office, in terms of feedback. So basically that is, I hope I've answered everything.
Mr. Matona?
No, just to add a little bit, Chair, on the question that was asked by Honorable Mudau, which is quite a profound question because it goes back to really what is the essence of being a public servant. And we now know that it is not something that we can take for granted, that public servants know and understand how they should conduct themselves, because very early on in our democratic dispensation, we adopted a set of norms and values, Batubili values, about how the public service should conduct itself. But in reality, it has not always turned out that way, the way the Batubili imagined what the public servants, all public servants, should be. We know that there are thousands and thousands and thousands of public servants who are responsible for delivering services to our people, who are responsible for serving people, who do not do it. So we know through the monitoring that we do, not only DPME, by the way, DPSA as well, and that there is a need to intervene. There is a need to intervene to foster this ideal public servant. And that to achieve that, we need to put in place a set of mechanisms, one of which is the presidential hotline. But you're quite right. The presidential hotline and the feedback that it gives us, the information, the picture that it paints, is not going to get us to where we want to go. It needs to be supported by other interventions. And in this regard, you will very correctly raise the intervention relating to performance monitoring, performance management, because accountability, ultimately, the framework for accountability of each and every public servant is the performance agreement that you sign and the things that you say you are going to do, the commitments that you undertake in terms of your performance. There too, things don't quite work well. So I'm sure DPSA will give you an indication on an ongoing basis how many public servants who ought to sign performance agreements are signed. And beyond that, are those performance agreements being evaluated and accountability been taken? The system is not functioning optimally. There are serious gaps. So there are still things that need to be done to make sure that the culture, the discipline, signing performance contract, being evaluated, being held accountable to that, and then also ensuring that there are consequence management. We're still a long way from that. So you raise a very, very important point. The second important issue arising from all of this is that we now know that service delivery is ultimately a whole of state, a whole of government. So the instances that Dr. Bihari referred to involve failure at the local level, which is escalated to the presidential hotline, and then the presidential hotline activates the other spheres of government to say, if it's a municipality in the province must also take responsibility. So we now know that to simply say no, the local sphere, will manage us and lead us of the local sphere will act as expected that has proven not to be always the case. So we need, therefore, from the center at least, to have line of sight in terms of service delivery, line of sight that cuts across all the spheres of government, and we identify the linkages and the connections around how we can make sure that service delivery is seamless. So I just wanted to just add those few points to support the responses of Dr. Bihari. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks very much. Honorable Nivot and Honorable Mutam for follow-ups.
Thank you, Chair. Just a quick question. Does the presidential hotline have a Twitter account? Because it might sound funny, but for me, like right now, Twitter is very effective because I tweet something as a general complaint, and then whoever I complain to contacts me, and they DM me, their direct message, and then I provide more detail, you know, like account numbers, reference numbers, etc. I can give as a direct message, obviously not as a general tweet, and I get a response back. So my question is that, does the presidential hotline have a Twitter account? And if not, why not? And it's something to consider as a more direct method of communication of content.
Yes.
Yes. Thanks, Chair. I'm covered by the response from Ms. Martin. And I'll have to leave for a while. I have something important to do, but I hope to be back. Yes.
Okay.
Sure.
Can we... okay, Honorable Tubazan.
Thank you so much. You know, when you're popped, you know. I'm just wondering, Che, that when the DPME was established, to actually ensure and do exactly what you still an acting DG or was it?
I'm not.
Okay, but you were there. They were supposed to make sure that performance contracts are signed, they are there, in all departments, and that the people that signed the contracts, they adhere to the terms and conditions of the contracts. Now, when you say seemingly the center, for me, something between Ghana ladies, the center, like, it's not holding. What exactly are you saying? Are you saying, indeed, the people were given this performance contract with those terms and conditions, they were assessed, they were evaluated, no consequences done? Is this what you're saying?
Yeah, sure.
Can we get responses?
I was just talking to the acting DG of DPSA, perhaps, because this is a very involved issue, we may need to come back and deal with it. But what the department does, DPME, in as far as the performance agreements of heads of departments, which is DGs, they get lodged at DPME. And the reason for that is because we want to see whether in those performance agreements are reflected the priorities and the overarching strategic objectives of government. So we assess the agreement. Are the targets clear? Are they measurable? Does it meet certain standards? And then we give feedback to the Director General or head of department. Beyond that, the management of the agreement is at the level of the department. It is the responsibility of the minister concerned and the Director General to enforce the agreement. That's a space that DPME doesn't, and by design, we're not able to intervene in. And also, we do through Parliament. I don't know if it still happens, but the report of how many directors general have concluded performance agreement and how many haven't, that type of thing. Also. Assist, Chair, but I think it's something that we we need to come back to, because I also am aware that the policy, the DPSA has revised the policy to make the system a lot more effective, because there were certain aspects of the system that made it complicated. For example, the performance evaluation panel required that the minister concerned and two other ministers and sometimes get those ministers together to do an evaluation. It's always a challenge, and as a result, you know, many DGs went for long periods without being assessed. So I'm saying, you know, the elements of the system are there. It's just a question of making them work as intended to help us achieve our objectives.
Thank you.
In response to the question of Twitter, the presidential hotline does not have Twitter, but the office, the DPME as a whole, has a Twitter account where citizens could contact the office there. But it is something that, you know, that we will look into. Thanks.
No, thanks, Dr. Biar and Mr. Matona, for the presentation and the responses. We'll then proceed to the acting DG and the chief negotiator. And congratulations on your appointment as the chief negotiator. Yeah.
Did you say commiserations?
Over to you, acting DG.
Thank you so much, Honorable Chair and members of the committee. You requested us to come and just share with you on this important issue. I'll take you through the presentations, and therefore, as Honorable Chair already indicated, there's a chief negotiator sitting next to me here who will ask us to take in questions in that regard. As a form of background, the Public Service Act provides in Section 2TA for functions and the composition of the Committee of Ministers for matters pertaining to salaries and other curriculum of service, a statutory matter and legislative issues. It further provides for Committee of Ministers to concur with determination on certain conditions of service of employees, one, on Public Service Act employees, educators, and members of the Defence Force and Social Services. In terms of background, on the 15th March 2017, Cabinet established the Committee of Ministers as an IMC to deal with the issue of wage negotiations. It further comments that ministers for MPSA consult with ministers to adopt the protocol of engagement, the ground rules, how you're going to engage, the behavior, the framework in that regard. Such protocol provide a mechanism to ensure a transparent intergovernmental processes. Committee of Ministers adopted the protocol on the 20 July 2017 after the establishment of the IMC by the President. This protocol was further discussed in the IMC chaired by the President on 22nd August 2017 for adoption. And therefore, Honorable Chair, members, that President requested to form part of the IMC is MPSA as the chairperson, basic education, corporate governance, defense and military veterans, finance, justice, cultural services, health, higher education training, home affairs, labor, police, planning, DPME, social development, and state security. This is the IMC established by the president deal with the issue of wage negotiations. The purpose and objective ensure, as I said, transparency and the process which is going to involve a provincial participation, and therefore to establish appropriate intergovernmental structures, both technical and executive, at bureaucratic level, at official level, and at executive level, and identify appropriate participation of employer representation in the various committees, and to define the process, I've said, the ground rules, how negotiations will be managed to the latter, and to define the roles and responsibility of each structure as established. There is what we call technical working group established by the executive authorities, which are ministers, which this structure is a working structure. Every day, this structure is working on these matters. Do your research, look at the economic outlook, look at the impact. So that structure on a day-to-day basis is doing that. It involves DPSA, National Treasury, and other officials that executives may want to deploy. Responsibility, as I said, is to ensure that we analyze in detail what Labour has put forward as their demands. And in that regard, that working structure will advise what they call the technical working structure of the DGs, of all ministers who are part of the IMCs. With this structure of the DGs is chaired by DG DPSA, and all DGs which are their ministers are part of the IMC. Responsibility to receive and consider proposal that the working group have developed, provide guidance on each proposal as presented by the Labour, and present recommendations to executive authority. The DGs now will advise ministers in terms of what needs to be done. Now, there is another structure which was established outside the IMC, because premiers are not ministers. Therefore, you need a structure that will bring in premiers as political heads of provinces, because provinces are also biggest employer, so they have to participate in this issue. The structure is called Executive Constitutive Committee, which are the following ministers: MPSA, Basic Education, Defense, Finance, Health, Justice, Police, State Security, and all premiers, and two DGs, DPSA and National Treasury. Its mandate is to receive and consider proposal from the Technical Constitutive Committee, finalize formal recommendations to the Committee of Ministers, which is called a mandating committee. The mandate is given in terms of what has been researched and analyzed, and what government can offer or afford, and advise on provincial national implications. As I said, the premiers come on board, they bring in their provincial advice in terms of their competencies in that regard, what is best for them in their sphere of operations. Now, in terms of the protocol itself, the protocol set out at high level, as I said, ground rules, functions, operations, and the responsibilities which are given to different committees. In terms of the protocol, as I've indicated, the functions of the IMC is to receive and consider proposal or recommendations. It's to provide clear parameters to the negotiating team under the leadership of the chief negotiator. Receive regular feedback on negotiations. Brief cabinet on the process. Consider and provide the revised mandate as and when required. Negotiations may get new mandate depend on the issue on the table at that time. Ensure financial implications after we've done the economic outlook. This committee is the one who must revise to say, because of these situations, we are the mandatory committee, we mandate you to negotiate along these lines. Now, in terms of Section 22A, capital A, small a, b1, it makes determination for any quantum of service for employee with concurrence of a committee of ministers that has been established. And therefore, I won't bore you with these colleagues and members. I already addressed the issue of function of the committees. I can move to the next slide, which is slide 12 on the mandating committee. That is provided for under part of 7th regulation, 783 of the PSR 2016 shall apply in terms of the chief negotiator as part of the negotiating team and nominated committee, one per department as a DG level and data level and higher from departments attached to ministers. What happened is that technical working group that is going to work, as I said, they may want to absorb other officials. But the protocol is saying person absorbed should be a director and higher. It can be a director and low. So it's part of the team that's going to ask the chief negotiator in the council negotiating. The chief negotiator has issued a receipt that he wants in the middle of the night. There's a team that he knows he can quickly activate to quickly provide, respond, and research. Whether they're deadlocks, want to provide empirical evidence, scientific information. So there must be a pool around him as part of researchers who assist in terms of providing that capacity to the negotiation team. Preparation for negotiations. Briefing of the committee. The committee ministers met 20th of July 2017 and the NIP was adopted. On 22nd August 2017, the IMC was appraised of the negotiations between protocol, and the Executive Committee of Ministers convened the 31st October 2017 when the NIP was concluded and adopted by the committee. On the 8th of November 2017, the NIP was considered with the organized labor and the working group in the presentation, and the meeting of ministers and the modern committee will take place next week, 28 November. There are two meetings. One meeting is the IMC, and therefore is the executive committee meeting of ministers, which is the modern committee. The technical working group, in consultation with the negotiation team, will prepare protocol to be considered in terms of the labor demands for that committee of ministers next week. In terms of slide 15, where it talks about the resolution 3 of 2017, parties in the PSABC evaluated the 2015 wage negotiations and are committed to approach these negotiations with a joint seeking solution, in that parties will spend significant time analyzing and understanding issues before seeking solution. Both parties, labor and employer. Yes, labor present their own demands, but they must go back further and do a lot of work in terms of the impact of their demands. Parties evaluate all possible solutions by assessing them against identified needs and the interests, as I said. There might be issues that labor may want to die for, issues that labor they may want to trade in the negotiations forum. It's upon labor to go back now and cascade and categorize their demands in line with government positions. Only after such assessment will the parties seek to select between possible alternatives, rejecting those found not to be suitable. In that exchange of information, now the two parties can begin to scale down and eliminate other issues that by now we are not privy for. We don't even know what will be that elimination. Now, parties commit to embark on a structured step-by-step process to identify and effectively deal with factors aggravating the conflict of negotiations. Hence, the protocol will guide us in terms of what needs to be done by when. and therefore we confine our negotiation within the parameters of the council. So we avoid negotiating outside the council or through the media as both parties. So the protocol does bind both parties. But whenever there's an issue, they must call each other back to the table in the PCBC. The purpose of this agreement, said parties joint commitment to conduct effective interest-based negotiations. We set out parties joint commitment certain shared objectives, and they will deal with the issue of timelines as identified. In terms of the PSBC schedule, we have made a high-level work plan, Chair and Honourable Members. In terms of process, we have said agreement on the time frame for pre-negotiations. We have said date 6 October, special council convene. Tabling of consolidated demands, trade union 6 October, vice chairpersons of labor. Exchange of relevant information, as I said. After we've analyzed submissions and proposal, we have to go back now and exchange. We give them our position, they give us what they are worked on in terms of their demands. So all parties via their secretariats or secretary general. We are saying 20 October, employers respond to the labor demands, not necessarily responding to each and every demand, but to the demand as presented, what is our attitude as government. And 29th, 31st October, pre-negotiations. 3rd November, submission of facilitator's report on pre-negotiations from both sides. Negotiations stage. We're saying 7 November to 15 December. We are committing to say with labor by all the attitudes and the indulgence provided by everybody, by 15 December we conclude negotiations. Members, I've given you the process, the step, the guidelines, what happens on the work plan in terms of what needs to be done to ensure that we meet the deadline of 15 December. I will quickly present to you what labor has presented. Yes, indeed, labor came, they've made their demands. The first demand for labor is to go for 1 year term of agreement. Colleagues will recall that we have just ended the 3-year term with a multi-term agreement this year for 2015. Now, labor is saying, for now, let's enter into a 1-year agreement. On the right, you'll see they've given motivation to say what informs us or what compels us as labor to say let's enter into a 1-year agreement. The motivation in part says the second and third year of multi-year term agreement tend to provide smaller increases to members. This is what labor is saying. To say if we agree in terms of economic outlook for now, we cannot project what will happen the second and third year. So give us year-to-year agreement. The second demand labor is saying there's resolution 3 of 2009. It says we need to review this resolution amongst others to reduce the time period for progression to allow employer to allow employees to be rated above average performance where such being the case and refrain from rating every employee as an average performer. Rate S3 to as a cost-cutting measure. They are saying we want to remove that. Labour demand the abolition of salary level 1 to 3, and the entry level should be 4. To say government got levels 1 to 16, we demand that 1 to 3 scrap. Let employees start at level 4 as entry level. The next one is your core bread and butter issues are increased. Labour is demanding that we categorize levels. After we remove 1 to 3, they're saying level 4 to 7, they demand 12%. Level 8 to 10, they demand 11%. Level 11 to 12, they demand 10%. This is what they're presenting. On the issue of the housing allowance, Labour demand for housing allowance to be increased to 2,500. I think currently it's 2,000. I'll give you the correct figures here. Payment of the housing allowance to both spouses who are public servants. Their motivation is every public servant sign an individual contract of employment with the employer. There is no contract as the spouse of public servants. There is no spousal contract. This is their argument. And therefore, spouse should be entitled to all the benefit that is due to him or her separately, as in the case of unmarried public servants or those married where the spouse is not employed in the public service. Still on the housing allowance, Chair and Honourable Members, Labour demand that the savings option in the housing scheme should be made a voluntary option. Their motivation is there are employees who will never, during their working life, be in position to purchase a house, or whose circumstances dictate that they should rent a house. They need the full housing allowance to cover their housing expenses, but is forced to pay the savings portion from their basic salary, thereby eroding their financial position. That's what Labour is motivating. Still on the housing allowance, Labour is demanding that employees should be paid out their savings from the scheme upon resignation from the public service. They motivate that savings portion of the housing allowance is part and parcel of the allowance and a benefit to an employee to which he or she is entitled. Homeowners and employees who rent receive the same housing allowance. When a homeowner resigns, he or she does not lose any part of the allowance received to date. It is therefore unfair and discriminatory that those who rent should forfeit their savings portion upon resignation. Labour further demand, still on housing allowance, a definition of permission to occupy, the PTO, must be drawn and subject to all respective directorates for ease of implementation. And the PIC must create a housing investment portfolio that will direct investments of the scheme. They are saying employees living in rural areas are deprived from their housing allowance in those cases where they produce their permission to occupy and the employers then refuse the submitted documents claiming that they were not meeting the requirements of the PTO. And the PIC currently already involved in the various investment projects such as office parks, malls, etc., which do not have a direct benefit to the owners of the funds, which are employees, while they are still in the service. On the issue of leave, Labour demand that a capped leave to be paid out to all public servants upon resignation. They are saying if you resign, you must pay your cap leave. Currently, the regulation doesn't allow. Family responsibility leave. The age gap of 18 years for children who need to be assisted during their illness to be removed. They are saying remove the cap of 18. If somebody is sick, as long as it's my child, will remain my child. I need leave to take care of my 40-year-old child. This is what labor is saying. Family responsibility leave to be granted to take care of a sick parent additional 3 days. They are demanding 3 days on top of this other leave to take care of the sick parents. On maternity leave, they demand that leave be granted to male employees under surrogacy agreements, meaning that even males should be entitled to for this. I think here there is a consult court judgment, which is now a case law or a precedent case that they're also referring to. The judgment in the labor court case number this between Mia and the CETA found that it amounted to determination that the applicant male was not granted 4 months maternity leave. The department was directed that in applying its policy regarding maternity leave, it shall recognize the status of parties to a civil union and not discriminate against the rights commissioning parents who have entered into a surrogacy agreement. So there is that quoting the president case or the case law in that regard, that it happened to CETA. And the CETA lost the case and they did not appeal for review. Temporary capacity leave to be granted by default to employees where the employer fails to comply with the time frame for investigation and feedback within 30 days. And leave for religious observation, they demand 3 days per year in terms of religious people to honor their religious customs. Leave for shop stewards and office bearers, labor, leave taken by shop stewards while initially on vacation leave to be converted to leave for trade unions. Meaning that as governments, in every department there are shop stewards. First, they are employees. These employees join organized labor. They are elected to become shop stewards. Now, labor is saying, when that person apply for annual leave, you go home. In your annual leave, organized labor need your service. They call you to come and do the work. You're not called by the employer. Organized labor. They are saying that calling should be converted to a special leave. Danger allowance. Labor demand a single comprehensive danger insurance in the public service in line with Public Service Quality Bargaining Standard Version 5 of 2015. The additions in fact recorded by sectors. On the pay progression to be allowed beyond top notches of salary level as well as personal salary notches. In simple terms, they are saying, if you are in level 5, you happen to reach your top notch, be allowed to punch to the next level, which is level 6. Don't stop moving. Move. So this is what labor is saying. Remove that. Okay, lifting of the moratorium of filling of vacancies, labor is saying, as far as they are concerned, governments have put in place moratorium. So they demand that that moratorium must be lifted. All outstanding agreements to be finalized and implemented during the current financial year. As far as labor is concerned, they are saying, this financial year, if there is any outstanding agreement, it must be finalized for this year. Chair and honorable members, I have given you all the labor demands. I won't go to the next slide, or the next is the same. The next one, it just gives you the economic outlook. As I said, work closely with the National Treasury. They've done the costing in that working team I referred to. Both departments work very hard. We have taken the costing to mandating committee of ministers. So in short, I can say, Honorable Chairperson, this is the presentation. My conclusion is the next pack of flight was to capacitate you more, and therefore at the end it shows you that after the economic outlook was conducted and the costing made on each demand by both departments, we arrived at a figure of 182 billion in 3 years ago. If hypothetically tomorrow the team under Mr. Poppy, as chief negotiator, says to government, a government agree with everything here, we need 282 billion the following week to cover all this demand. Chair, I thank you so much.
Thanks for the presentation, DG Chief. There's the framework, members, of negotiation with workers. Can we have questions or comments?
Honorable Lesoma, Honorable Van der Waal, Honorable Kota, Honorable Zanya, yeah, in that part.
Thank you, Chair. For me, it won't be a question. It will be a general comment that probably I'm happy that MQDG is aware that at nowhere as this portfolio committee we want to have negotiations outside negotiation tables, as it were, in terms of our responsibilities. However, one will like, within the time frame that you have said, that a sense of comfort moving forward, even through the IMC, to say there will be no disruption of public service, as it were, whatever, but also take into account that in terms of our financial standing, we're not in good shape. The other thing, Chair, I would like to come back when we're not dealing with the wage negotiations outside, that when it has been completed, because it might be also be a controversial matter, but I'm saying I'm here because it also take on board the outstanding agreed agreements as how you intend moving forward. Thanks, Chair.
Honorable Kosa.
Thank you, Chair. I'm also having clarity seeking questions, two of them. One is on the protocol of engagement. You presented that it only consists of interministerial committees. My question is, where is organized labor on this? When you set the ground rules, you set them while they are outside, then you call them to come and participate. I wanted to check if really that we will be accepted by them. But check that. And the other issue, you never gave reasons behind the scraping of level 1, 2, 3. But on the other issues, you cited, but it's not you, but it's the labor unions. But I don't know, maybe you have just mentioned their reasons behind why are they saying we need to scrap level 1 and go and start in level 4. Do they have reasons behind that? Thank you very much.
Honorable Fanapot.
Thank you for this sort of keeping us updated as we requested. It's appreciated, and I think to the negotiator chief, we understand that not all the cards can always be on the table as long as we are updated as things are going. And I share Honourable Lesoma's issue with regards to service delivery disruptions, that we should avoid that. But that should also not be the carrot in front of government's nose to get what they want. Now, Chair, first of all, I'll start at the bottom. The acting DG said Labour's demand comes to the amount of 282.1 billion rand. Just for clarity for everybody, also tell us what our budget said we could spend on this part of the cake. I would like to first ask then, last year the Minister of Finance in 2016 said that they will work on a 25 billion rand cut on getting a more slimmer wage bill. How did we do on that? Did we actually achieve some of that over that 3-year period that was announced? I would also like to see that the Finance Minister in the 2017 MTB's PS commented that CPI plus one increases would actually, and I quote, raise the national shortfall in 2018-19 to 8.2 billion rand, with a gap in provincial compensation budgets amounting to 4 billion rand. So that comes right from there. And how would this then affect this part of government's expenditure? And I have some questions. First of all, on slide 12, where we speak of the chief negotiator, if you look at the second bullet, we say the negotiating team may include, and then you go to the chief negotiator, nominate reps, number of reps, blah, blah, blah. But in that one sentence, we say the chief negotiator of the state must attend the meetings of the technical consultative committee. So are we saying the may in the second thing, it will always include the chief negotiator and the may is on an extension of the rest? Because I would imagine, if I understand this correctly, the chief negotiator must always be part of that. I'll go quickly to this. I also would like some clarity on, I can understand that vacant posts, the funded posts, that they be filled. But it's also true if you go and look at the whole of the public sector, there are posts that have been standing vacant for 3-4 years. And would they really then be such a crucial matter if you demand they all be filled? If you get along for 4 years without a specific position filled, I think by now you've proved you can be without it. Mm-hmm. So there could be a saving. I'm also very concerned that the housing allowance, am I correct in saying it's about 1,200 at the moment, mm-hmm. going up to 2,500?
Yeah.
So, okay, so that's almost double then per... employee. There's something I didn't quite understand, and that was that leave towards religious observance or something. Like, maybe you can just explain to us.
3 days.
Is that just adding?
18.
Okay. Adding 3 days to your annual leave, then.
Yeah.
Is that what it means?
Yeah.
Okay, then I'm covered.
Yeah.
I'm not very sure on slide 29. And you need to convince me, or with time we have to be convinced, chairperson, that a 1-year term would have zero cost implication. Because then there must be a guarantee that there won't be a strike or other demands and stuff like that. I'm not saying you must go to 3 years. I'm not promulgating any favor here of 1 or 3 years now. I'm just saying, what's the guarantee that the 1-year term would have no additional cost? And Chair, I'm also worried on page 31, you know, levels 11 to 12 is the highest levels. Now, if they go and give those people 10%, but the lowest levels, the gap is still very big, is it fair? I'm just asking, and I'm sorry for the seniors that sit here to respond, but... It is a concern. Are we bringing people in income groups or different levels closer to each other, or are we making the gap even bigger. I mean, the economy is really hitting those with the lowest incomes the hardest, I would think. And Chairperson, I'm almost done. I just want to go... I'll take a second round. Let somebody else go now.
Honourable Duwazan.
Thank you so much, Chairperson, and thank you from the acting DG. Chairperson, these problems have been there for years. And if one of us today can actually say the labor is being unreasonable, then it means we are not okay. Because all those demands have been there for years. 2010, I was still in finance, and you were where you were. Where us, the finance committee, looking at the economic outlook and the fiscus, the way we're collecting the fiscus, we realized that that cycle, we're not going to be able to reach the demands of the labor. Then we said, let's come up with some models to meet the demands of the public servants. It is therefore, Chairperson, surprising that the team to this date, they just started from the clean ground like nothing was ever happened about these issues. I'll give you an example. We said the PIC, the money that is sitting in the PIC belongs to the public servant. We said as the Finance Committee, Treasury together with their colleagues, they need to sit down and come up with a model as to how to assist the public servants who cannot purchase their houses because of the notch that they're sitting in, and so at the end of the day they are being assisted by their own money before we take their money and invest it in the infrastructure or outside of South Africa. Did that ever happen? It looked like nothing happened. Now, if we're looking at the leave themselves, we said they are already 3 days because it's that two leave which we propose, which is a family leave, which is a responsibility, social, what is that? Family responsibility leave. And there's another day which you do not have, you don't need to submit a medical certificate or what, but you can just take it without being accounted for it. So I am saying, Chairperson, maybe somehow, somewhere, as legislators, we did not follow. Because we were to make sure that the Labour Act tally with the TLAB, the tax amendment laws then, to ensure that these models, they come up, if indeed the models did work. Because right now we are sitting with this and there is no way they are not going to go for the strike. So I am requesting that Chairperson, this committee, we request the Treasury, the DPSA, the Labour, to tell us what are they going to do. Because it is there. The bomb is going to be there. Because those issues have been there. Was the model there? Did they come up with a model? Where the fiscus contributed by the public servant appropriated correctly to alleviate, because the country does not have the money, that's true. But we did have some strategies and proposals that we proposed that they have to be done by the MIC, which it looked like to this date it never happened. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Nivot.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. My one question of clarity, the housing allowance and housing subsidy, is it the same thing or is it two different things? If you can just explain that. And then my second question, I am very concerned to see about the age of the children who reach 18. If I'm a parent, as a civil servant, and I have a child who is 30 or 40 years old with a disability, maybe I've never disclosed that my child with a disability that my child has a disability, but they depend on me. So the age of 18, that's, you know, it concerns me. I must be allowed as a parent who have children. If they are over 18, you know, they do depend on me. Does it cover that? So just those questions. Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Van der Walt.
I'm sorry, Chair. I just want to go back to the Consumer Price Index remark or comment I made. And what I wanted to come out of that is actually, is that government starting point for negotiations or not?
So over to your acting DG.
Okay, thanks, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. The Chief Negotiator is also here. I think by now it's within the heat. Thank you so much. Let me start by May and March that you raise. I think it's slide 12. There's no confusion. Slide 12 talks about the team of chief negotiator. The team. As I said, he may. If he's busy negotiating in the council, he finds that this matter I need research, he may quickly get a resource. There will be a team around him. He may. That's very clear. That must is a meeting of ministers. He must attend that meeting. The two are different. He sits here as a chief negotiator to say, I want capacity. We are saying as government, we'll put a pool around you. That pool may not be in Centuria, in the council, maybe in the office, but activate. He may activate. That meeting of ministers, he must attend to brief ministers. So I've clarified that, Honorable Chair. The next question, I really first take acknowledge comment raised by Honorable Lesuma. I really appreciate it. That is government view that there should be no strikes. I think we start by saying, as you can see even now, there are no media statement, there's nothing. Government is containing that environment. So we encourage that even after this meeting, we can still go on, contain that environment. The spirit is there, Honorable Chairperson. Now, the issue of Minister of Finance, 25 billion cuts, I may say to you, government departments are required to cut on their personnel. So we are doing that to cover for that money because we are not deep in the reserve. But this is a talk of other day. I'm just saying, as government departments are required to cut on the personnel to begin to subsidize our reserves that are already deep in to support the Minister of Finance speech.
This week.
Come again?
My question is, yeah, this week.
No.
Government, we are. We are requested, government requested to, yes.
Answer the question.
Yes.
And if there's an outstanding question or a follow-up question, it will be asked.
No. I'm just saying.
In the process, if possible, as brief as possible,
yes,
but
yes.
Make sure that the answer will satisfy the member.
What I'm saying is that government departments are required to cut on their personnel. It's not two-way. You cannot balloon your structure anymore. You must cut. That comes the question raised that if positions remain vacant, after 6 months it turns unfunded. You don't need it. That's also part of saving. You don't need a position. Treasury, come and take the money. So that has been addressed. On the question, Honorable Tibasana, on the issue of these are new demands. These are not old demands. Every cycle we get demands. We treat demands as new. We don't negotiate on the basis of what happened in 2010. This is what Labour gave us now to say this is our demand. So we treat this as new demands. There are no old demands as far as we are concerned as government. On the issue of leave, it's regulations. What I'm presenting here, Chair, is that this is what Labour presented on top of what is there. These are not new things. They are saying, in all our benefits, add this. We are not removing that one day leave that can go to medical doctor or it can go. No, 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 no. Those is additions. What is here, Che, is additions to current benefits. There's nothing new. We are not substituting. We are not bringing in. We are just adding to what they are saying. On the issue of Chief will respond if committee want to call COSA to and the National Treasury and everybody here. I think that is parameters he will respond. I'll give that question to him. I'm finalizing my question. On the issue of 18 years, I think it's a law in this country that you are a child up to 18 years in terms of the Children's Act. It means if you revoke that law here, you must amend that legislation. Because you do what you call clumsy statutory amendments. There's a law in this country which says you remain a child up to 18 years. After 18 years, you're no longer a child. So we cannot entertain that as a separate case. We have to amend other legislation in the country. And that will cause commotion of a reference in terms of legal statutes. Housing allowance, he will respond. Yeah, Honorable Chair, I think we'll get to negotiate.
Thank you, Chairperson, members of the committee. I'll be very brief, because I know this is not a negotiating camp.
They might meet you for hours, sir.
On the 27th of June, we signed a protocol agreement. So the employer is a custodian of that agreement. A violation of that agreement means a violation of collective bargaining. Therefore, there are issues listed on that protocol agreement. Some of the issues the DG has already engaged on them. Briefly, I may say the objective of this agreement is to make sure that engagements are conducted in good faith. Individuals are given an opportunity to present issues formally and be realistic in engaging on a range of issues tabled there. Now, if the employer is a signatory to this agreement, whatever we engage on in terms of those demands, Chair, we need to be very careful that we are not starting to violate the agreement. The question of the wage gap, I heard about it. Wage gap is not part of the demand. Housing allowance and housing subsidies. These are two different things. We all are aware of the government employee housing scheme, of which tomorrow we are moving into the council. We have a draft that we may sign. That has to do with housing allowances and those savings that I had some members talking about. A subsidy
you have something and I'm assisting you, it's something separate. Yeah, I think that is it.
No, I maybe will allow a member one question follow up. Not more than that, if there is any. Honorable Lusuma.
Chair, for me it will not be a question again. It's to say, moving forward, probably we might also need to get a status of the unfilled post and their duration, because there is that. I remember in the previous DG when we raised this issue that if we haven't filled up the post for more than 12 months, automatically don't need that post.
Mm.
And he was with a negative response on that, on saying, no, you can't, and all that.
Mm.
So that we can also closely monitor that. Quickly, Chair, probably also our engagements here, we tend to have a legal spillover on other departments, so to speak, i.e., their age. Secondly, the issue that has been raised by Honorable Velma also, in terms of people living with disabilities, because there's something that we're saying we're prioritizing them as well, but we're not. But I'm saying moving forward, not outside this process. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you. Any other comment or question, Honorable Tubazan?
Thanks so much, Chair. Chair, I want to endorse this. Theoretically, to the acting DG, theoretically, they are new. But reality, they are old demands. So what I'm requesting the acting DG to do is to take this to the team, especially to his boss, that can they revisit what was proposed in 2010 by whatever team that was set that time?
Thank you. Honorable Van der Waal.
Now, just to emphasize the issue of the vacant post, because surely if you say it's redundant, I don't know if in these demands that they might found it to be redundant or not. And as Honorable Lesuma said, that's why we must get the report. And I take it then, if there's no reference by the negotiator or yourself, DG, that the reference to CPI is a bit not allowed to speak or comment on now. But I mean, the finance minister, Chair, didn't say what it is. The result of that is, and I was just,
Honorable Nivot.
Thank you, Chair. If the department is using the Children's Act in terms of the age of 18, I would also like to ask the department to look at the Children's Act in relation to adults who are dependent. You know, meaning children with disabilities who are adults, they depend on their parents, and what does the Act say about that? I would like them to look at that too, please. Thank you.
So, brief responses.
I'll be quick, Honorable Chair.
And so, don't respond to comments, but to questions.
Yes, comments, I've appreciated them. I've noted them. And the question raised, Honorable Suma, on the issue of unfit position, I've noted that question. The last question, still on the issue of age. Here, we are responding to what we're given. We are not disputing that question, Honorable Chairperson. Perhaps we may advise Labour in the negotiations. You will note it when you go back. But government here, we need to respond to what we're given. We cannot give a different letter, not respond to what we're given. So it's still a good question, but we have to cross-reference it with our statute, as I said. The next one, Honorable Chair, is the issue of redundancy of position. There is no redundancy here of position. Labour is just saying, if there's a moratorium, lift it. And as we are concerned, there was never a moratorium in government. It's just departments don't fill their positions. If they don't fill their positions, after a certain period, it becomes unfunded because you don't need it. You don't need them. Treasury will take the money back to the fiscus. So the last input, Chair, on the response is the issue of theoretically. As government, we cannot go 2010 demands. We cannot. It's noted. But I'm just saying, we can't go there as government.
Thank you very much. I think we have come to the end. We should thank the officials and the two departments for the presentation, and good luck, Chief Negotiator, once more. It's a tough one, but we know you will make it, and you have our support. Yeah.
Thank you very much. We would humbly request and pray that you pray for us, because I could hear the word of industrial action time and again kicks in. Yeah, we survived 2010. Thank you.
we will allow you to quietly move out, because we have item 5, which is consideration of reports which we should process. Can we have the report distributed, Ms. Collins?
Honourable Chair, I need to leave soon, so could we please go through vote 10, because that's the original that I have.
Yeah, it's okay. We will then start. I just wanted to wait until we have all the report, vote 10 and 8 and 12. We'll then start with vote 10 as requested. Are there comments on page 1? Page 2? Page 3? Page 4? Page 5? Page 6, page 7, page 8, page 9, page 10, page 11,
Yeah.
Okay, Honorable Nipo.
On page 11, 4.9, the second line, program 2, was not achieved. So the was is missing. Oh, sorry, were. Interpreter's mistake. Were not achieved.
Okay. Yeah.
And then 4.12. Okay, now 4.12 has been corrected. That's fine. And okay, the rest have been corrected. I just want to check 4.15. Yes, okay, it's perfect. They've all been corrected. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable van der Walt.
Chair, no, I don't have a serious problem. It's different from 4.12. I went through my notes but couldn't read my own handwriting. I'm not so sure if we actually commended DPSO, because remember they started late. And we were concerned at the time that the negotiation started late. So I'm not sure that we gave them a compliment.
Yeah, but I think it's a comment. You commended them for the fact that negotiations have started.
Then let's just say, maybe by the committee on the starting of the, or something like that.
The DPSA was commended by the committee on the progress on the wage negotiations and the fact that there was a mandatory body established such as the Inter-Ministerial Committee, though the negotiations started late, if we want to put something like that.
Yeah. Okay, I just thought maybe the DPSA was commended for finalizing and starting, because before your time, remember, we raised the issues that it didn't come and then the minister said they would come.
Okay.
Or commended them
commended
to now agree to report to us regularly or something like that. But in the beginning, they were late, so we didn't commend them on that.
Okay. Honorable Kosa.
Yeah, I wanted to say that according to our understanding that they were commended for their performance, for the work that they have done. We were not looking at she's raising the issue that they came late, but here it's just specific that something happened, has been done, and they were commended for that. That was my take.
Yeah.
They didn't start by then.
Yeah, no, they are saying that they started 2 weeks late.
Yeah.
So, yes, they've started 2 weeks late. However, the committee commended them for the fact that they have started with the negotiations.
Yeah.
I thought she
will
she
now
was,
start.
No, the negotiations have started because, the fact that they've put a framework and the workers have submitted their demands. The negotiations have started. It's just that to then the nitty-gritties of negotiations, you know, have not necessarily started because they said they are starting somewhere with November. I haven't picked up the date. Not that I missed up the date, but they've set the date which ends on the 15th of December. Yeah, so. I thought just to take everybody on board, if you put a sentence or a word that takes into consideration the issues that are being raised, because the issue here is that we can't commend the department, that is not the issue. We are commending the fact that they have started.
Started and agree to give regular feedback.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough. Can we adopt the report with those amendments? Honorable Nsuma?
Thanks, Chair. I move that the vote 8 report be adopted by the committee for processing.
Thank you. Any seconder? Well, Honorable Nibut? Vote 10. Then vote 8. Page 1. Page 2. Page 3. Page 4. Page 5. Page 6. Page 7. Page 8, page 9, and page 10. There are no comments. Can we move for the adoption of the vote 8? Honorable Corson.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I move that the report vote 8 be adopted. Thank you.
Any seconder? Honorable Dwazan.
I second the move for the adoption of the vote 8.
Thank you. Vote 12, Stats SA, page 1, page 2, page 3, page 4, and page 5. Can we move for the adoption of the vote 8? Vote 12, I'm sorry. Honorable Duwazani.
I move for the adoption of the vote 12.
Any seconder? Honorable Soma. Thank you. I think we have a minute.
No.
Oh, okay. These are the only reports. Okay. Are there announcements? We are going to have our last meeting next week, Wednesday. And we can't wish you well. We will wish you well on that day when we meet. I don't know what the procedure is expected for that meeting. Honorable Lusuma, I see your hand is up.
Thanks, Chair, for the offer. It's a request that when we look at our next quarter program, which I would request that we should finalize it this current term, for the reasons that you raised even last time in terms of the meeting value. Secondly, there was a project, so to speak, international study tour that was mooted that we must bring it back so that it can be processed before it's too late. But not on the same heading because its relevance has fallen out now, Chair.
Yeah, okay, thanks very much. I think we'll just have to remind each other about this overseas visit, what must happen, then we will then do what is necessary. But I think with the issue you've raised that we come up with our plan for the coming year, we'll look at that and make sure that we do our things speedily so as to avoid this venue as far as possible, because you know when it's hot it's terrible. We're lucky today because it's a bit cold. Yeah, but thanks very much, members, for your indulgence and participation. The meeting is adjourned. See you next week. Thank you.
I don't know what you're talking about. Well, I think that's the beauty of yesterday's
So far, on the program.
You're absolutely